This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
The messy and hasty evacuation of Americans, American allies, and other internationals from the Taliban-led Afghanistan suffered a horrifying setback yesterday with a deadly terrorist attack. It really underscores all the problems associated with America's surrender and retreat. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, this is a terror attack that was largely forecast by the United States government, by commentators as well, that this was something that was bound to happen as America is retreating out of Afghanistan, especially in these really heavily populated areas, the choke points, the bottlenecks for American citizens, passport holders, Afghanis that had worked with the United States in the past, as they try to get out of Afghanistan before September 1st to the international airport there in Kabul, that this would be a hotspot for a terrorist attack or a magnet for a massive high casualty terrorist attack involving U.S. servicemen because of their need to guard the gates to the airport. And indeed, this is what happened on Thursday evening. This was a suicide attack. There are numerous accounts of what happened, but it looks like a vehicle was involved that was driven and then exploded, firefight, and then potentially in a secondary explosion close by. All up, the death toll right now is at 170 people just before we record this, and 13 American servicemen were killed. This is the deadliest day in Afghanistan for over a decade for the United States. And of course, the people that were involved that weren't American servicemen, well, we don't have a list of names attached to those people. And given the fact that this was by an entrance to the airport, there's likely a bunch of Americans in that list also. They're still trying to make out who these people are. So we'll see going forward whether there is another such attack, but it is providing, I guess, some haste for the United States to get out of there because they're not in control of the security situation outside of the airport.
Stephen Fleury has been bringing this out, that you're getting this message from the Biden administration saying we've completed our mission in Afghanistan. We knocked out Osama bin Laden. We neutralized Al-Qaeda. So mission accomplished. And at the same time, we need to get out of here as quickly as possible because of the threats of terrorist attacks. Joe Biden, after this took place, he said that we are going to strike this ISIS-K group that has claimed responsibility hard. So the war on terror apparently is going to continue even after the evacuation.
Right. And so you ask the question, how does the United States do that? I mean, it's one thing to come out and say that we're going to strike this terrorist group, this vague terrorist group hard, and then remove the forces that would do such an attack from the country. And so retribution obviously is something that Americans would probably like at this point, but it's hard to see how that would happen. What people really need to understand more than anything is that the Taliban is in charge of the security. This is of everything in Kabul, and leading that exercise is the Haqqani network. They're in charge of the Taliban security. The Haqqani network is an Al-Qaeda brand, has worked with Al-Qaeda very closely, just like the Taliban have. The leader of the Haqqani network has a $5 million American bounty on his head right now. So the group that's in charge of securing Kabul, the leader of that group has a $5 million bounty on his head from the United States for killing Americans. And so when you see an attack that takes place like this, right at the airport itself, where the American servicemen are and 13 Americans are killed, this is not purely the actions of some rogue terrorist group. Everyone's going to be talking about ISIS-K, this Islamic State Khorasan, just a variation of the Islamic State in Syria, that have fought against the Taliban in the past few years. However, just as Americans need to pass through at least half a dozen checkpoints, Taliban checkpoints, to get to the airport, and a lot of them are being held up, so too did this vehicle laden with explosives get through at least half a dozen Taliban checkpoints to make its way to the airport to be detonated. So we can talk about, and this is going to be the narrative that comes out of the US press and even from the White House, that this is some random terrorist group. No, the very group that is in charge of Kabul security, the Taliban, that America has now outsourced its own security to, the Taliban, that America will outsource the getting the last remaining American citizens out of the country after September 1st, when the United States exits, the Taliban, is the very group that allowed this terrorist attack to take place. It gives you an idea of the loss, that's the defeat that's happened in Afghanistan, but also it lets you know that what's coming ahead is not going to be good for those remaining Americans inside the country.
Yeah, super, super important point. And the fact is that the United States is responding to this terrorist attack by basically saying, this just underscores the need for us to work together with the Taliban against these terrorist groups within the country. In the meantime, news has emerged that the United States has actually supplied the names of Americans and American allies, Afghan allies, to the Taliban, presumably to aid the evacuation effort. But this just reflects an extraordinary lack of recognition of the reality of the group that we're working with here.
Right. So this came out from Politico. This was shortly before the explosion last night, that the United States officials gave the Taliban, this is going back, I guess, about almost a week now, a list of names of American citizens, green card holders, Afghan allies, etc. Basically, anyone that could come to the United States, that they wanted to come to the airport to get on planes to be evacuated to the United States. There was a list of those names that was given to the Taliban so that the Taliban could allow these people to pass through the checkpoints, supposedly, to get to the airport, to venture out on planes. This is a stunning betrayal of the people that, you know, are terrified of the Taliban.
Right. One congressman called it a kill list.
Yeah, that's one defense official in this article. Basically, they just put all those Afghans on a kill list. It's just appalling and shocking and makes you feel unclean, he said. Because, again, this is how these organizations work. Yes, the United States might leave. They might take some of their citizens with them. But all those that have been working with the Americans, down to the electrician that's worked on the base of gone to an American serviceman's house to fix his electricity, those guys are targeted. They're targeted by the Taliban and others else after. And so what did you have? You had the United States government give this massive list of everyone that was eligible to come. And then what did the Taliban do? They clogged all the checkpoints and all the areas on the way to the airport with other Afghans, with to make it more difficult for those to actually get through. So as of Wednesday, the United States actually stopped saying to people that weren't American citizens or have dual citizens from even coming to the airport. They said, we'll contact you. And so it's like the Taliban got this list, and then they prevented those very people from getting there. And then the Americans basically made the list even smaller of those that were going to be accepted onto flights. And so the United States government right now is coming out saying there's only 1,500 or probably less than that Americans that want to leave Afghanistan. Those that want to leave, there's only 1,500 of them left. This was a massive number. It came a very small number. A day earlier, there was 15,000. 15,000 Americans or dual citizens or so on, passport holders, green card holders that could leave. Now there's only 1,500. So what happened? Well, the American government determined, because these people could no longer get to the airport, that they did not want to come to America. And so we're talking about a number of about 10,000, 15,000 individuals that now the Taliban has names of, and probably biometric data of also, like everything that they can use to trace these people and know who they are. The Taliban has a list of about 10,000 people that are going to be stuck in Afghanistan after September 1st, that the government, US government, has said, we are going to work with the Taliban to try and get these people out. Why would the Taliban have any incentive to try and get these people out after the fact? Instead, what's more likely is, just as Iran has done in the past, they'll be used as bargaining chips in the future to get a lot of money, it seems, or other favors from the United States government.
It's easy to see, to imagine all kinds of nightmarish scenarios emerging from this. It's hard to see how this ends in anything but just a series of tragedies. It's hard to even, we're going to have to keep our eyes on everything that that takes place in the days ahead, but we're talking about a hard and fast August 31st deadline here. We're at August 27th. We've had congressmen say there's no way that we're going to be able to get everybody out even by September 11th, even if we were to continue. Justin Trudeau from Canada says Canada's done. We've evacuated everybody we're going to evacuate. And Trudeau says, I understand the heartbreak of those who were not able to get out. Apparently, that's all he can offer, is understanding of the heartbreak. And you could see this playing out on thousands upon thousands of times, not to mention those who, once that August 31st deadline is passed, what sort of actions are we going to see from the Taliban against those who are left behind?
Right. There's only horrible scenarios that come out of it from this point on. Again, I think it is shocking that past August 31st, I mean, you are going to be left with these people there, and they're going to have to make strategic decisions. Are they going to, I mean, is the United States really going to advise these people, go and talk to the Taliban so they can help you get out past August 31st, when there's no American servicemen left in the country, or very little, probably none left in the country? I mean, these people are going to be on the run. They'll go into hiding, and perhaps the United States can say then, well, they obviously didn't want to leave because they didn't go to the Taliban to ask for help. It's just a shocking betrayal, I think, of those that are there, but that also there's so many ways to look at this that have all been discussed, I think, of just what our other American allies are thinking right now, just looking at how the partners have been treated. And looking at an American administration that it seems like they could have done a whole lot more in the past couple of weeks, even with the failures of leaving the Bagram Air Base early, pulling the troops out before you get the people out, all of that. I just read a report today that over the past 2 days, 600 of these important individuals were plucked out of Kabul, not by the U.S. military, but by a volunteer group of ex-U.S. military that basically said, we're going to go get our friends. Mm. And they got 600 people, 600 actual, not just random refugees that are coming on planes, like yep. The bulk of what the American military has done. They went out there, and it was possible. We saw the French do it, the Germans did it, the Brits did it.
If the United States had the will.
The United States did it. They just stuck back at the airport. And you bet those servicemen were just pulling their hair out, thinking, we can go get people. We can go get people. But the leadership from the top did not want that. They wanted to outsource the defense of Americans to the Taliban. I mean, we do have this push, just like we saw in the mid-2000s and into Obama's time with what happened in Iraq, the push to moderate Iraqi Shiite militias, to moderate Iran. And we're seeing it right now. To moderate the Taliban, to make the Taliban be looked at as being a partner, that's the word that is used now by General McKenzie, a partner. They're our partners, the Taliban. Well, this is shocking, even going back a month. Who would have said such a thing? And so we are moderating the terrorists. The terrorists are no longer terrorists. They're the good guys that we can work with. And And again, we have talked about at length, and Mr. Fleury has written about the fact that the foreign policy of the Biden-Obama administration is to strengthen radical Islam across the Middle East, typically led by Iran, but also the Taliban has got help from Iran as well. And we are seeing this again, giving the Taliban the greatest PR, the United States is the greatest PR outfit for the Taliban that we can see. We're working it in many different ways to make everyone think the Taliban is good. And they're radical Islamists. Christopher Reams had an amazing article, that 2,500 word article that documents the atrocities of the Taliban in the past month. People should read that. If they're reading anything about, here's our partners, look at what they've done in the last month. This is not a partner for peace. This is just strengthening radical Islam in the Middle East.
The title of that article by Chris Eames, Wolves in Wolves Clothing. He spoke about it on Trumpet Hour on Wednesday. You can hear him give that report on this show. We also have Stephen Fleury's article, Afghanistan Chaos by Design. This, as Brent said, this is not just bungling. This is decisions being made in the worst possible outcome, and not in America's interest, not in our allies' interest, and deliberately so. Go check that article out by Stephen Fleury. He's been talking about that quite a lot on the Trumpet Daily Show this week. Really just must-watch viewing for all of our listeners out there. We appreciate that, Brent. And just to underscore this, usually when America retreats from a war zone, it destroys all the military hardware it leaves behind so as not to allow it to fall in the hands of the enemy. In this case, though, it did the extreme opposite of that. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, in regards to that chaos by design point, it was actually last Thursday that President Donald Trump finally weighed in on this Afghan fiasco, making just the really logical point that, like, if you wanted to do a withdrawal from Afghanistan, if you wanted to get your soldiers out of Afghanistan, he said, first you bring out all the American citizens, then you bring out all the equipment, then you bomb the bases into smithereens, and finally you bring out the military. You don't do it in the reverse order like Biden and our woke generals just did, which is just, yeah, it's chaos by design. And the fact that they actually brought out like all their military soldiers, or most of their military soldiers, first left the weapons behind, and now you've got, like I said, 1500 American citizens there that can't get out because the soldiers are gone.
15,000.
Right. But they're still getting out new data on just the quantity and quality of weapons that were left behind. They've closest I can figure now, they left $85 billion worth of weapons behind in Afghanistan. And by comparison, the GDP of Afghanistan is about $20 billion. So they've left like four times what the nation's even worth financially in weapons. You can see videos of just like pallets of not even weapons but money as well, where you've got every like a bundle, like a brick of money, probably about $5,000-$10,000 a piece, just stacked in bricks on like pallets. So it's I don't think they've determined exactly how much are on those pallets, but millions and millions of dollars that the Taliban can now spend on whatever they want. I think that's included in the $85 billion worth of weapons, but you're looking at 2,000 armored vehicles, like Humvees and MRAPs, over 75,000 total vehicles, if you include like Ford Rangers and other trucks, several different types of helicopters, like 45 Black Hawk helicopters, 50 Scout attack choppers. We've got like 30 military version Cessnas. That's like a prop plane. At least 600,000 small arms, M16s, M249s, and so you're looking at 600,000. There's actually, as best as they can calculate, only about 75,000 people in the Taliban, and so that's like 7-8 assault rifles per person, unless they sell to some other terrorist group for more cash. You've got over 20,000 grenades, millions of rounds of different type of ammunitions, night goggles, yeah, and the list just goes on and on and on and on and on of stuff that I guess allegedly they said they were leaving behind to give the Afghan military to defend themselves from the Taliban. Although by this case, it's pretty clear to anyone involved that that's not going to happen, and there is still time to bomb those bases, like Donald Trump had suggested, but no one's doing it, which can only leave you with the conclusion that the Biden administration actually wants this $85 billion worth of equipment in the Taliban's hands.
You know, none of this makes any sense unless you've been reading what Gerald Fleury has been writing for the last several years about Antiochus and the Antiochus administration, the spiritual dimension to what is happening politically in the United States, the motivation behind these otherwise completely illogical and head-scratching decisions is so important for us to recognize. I think all of what Gerald Fleury has been saying about just the satanically inspired thinking behind a lot of these decisions is just coming to the fore in a way that nothing that has happened to this point, not even the Iran nuclear deal, it seems, has reached this level of just blatant anti-American, pro-Iranian, pro-terrorist thinking behind what we're seeing right now.
Right, yeah, he has that section in the America Under Attack booklet. I think it's specifically in regards to Libya, although this situation is about an order of magnitude worse than that, where even bringing out that is, like I said, you can't explain this away with incompetence. It has to be malevolence. It's yours. Occasionally, you'll find a botched withdrawal, probably like when the Americans withdrew from Saigon in the Vietnam Wars. Like maybe you could chalk some of that up to just an incompetence in how the withdrawal was done. But like I said, you just can't attribute it to like that. Like Trump said, is like I said, even if you wanted to abandon Afghanistan to the Taliban, it's like, I don't know why that's a good idea, but even if you wanted to, it's like, at least bring your people and your weapons out before you bring your soldiers out. Because if you bring your soldiers out first, you're kind of telling the world that you want your people to be slaughtered and your weapons to be stolen.
Yeah. Well, I would definitely encourage you to read the book Great Again that Gerald Fleury has written. And he specifically has a chapter in there on the Antiochus administration's approach toward Iran. That is very much worth reading. And it's, as I said, a very important perspective to maintain as you're watching what's happening here in Afghanistan. We thank you for that, Andrew. We're working on our upcoming print edition and focusing all that is happening here. One very important aspect of all of this is just the international ripple effects of this withdrawal from Afghanistan. We'll talk about one of those effects that happened this week, a telling move from Germany's chancellor. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this time last Friday, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel was visiting with Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin. And I think this reaction is incredibly revealing. You know, disaster hits in Afghanistan. You have people like the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is desperately trying to get a hold of the American President Joe Biden and is left unable to get a hold of him for 36 hours. You know, he instinctively turns to America. Okay, we need to work together. What can we do? Angela Merkel in Germany, on the other hand, she immediately runs over to Vladimir Putin and works on this relationship. And I think that tells us a lot about the Russian-German relationship right now. And when she arrived in Moscow, Vladimir Putin really did roll out the red carpet for her. He hosted her in the hall of the Order of St. Alexander Nevsky. It's one of the most opulent rooms in the Grand Palace of the Kremlin. It's just outside the throne room. It's the first time any world leader has been hosted there, and they held a press conference there. So just even in the venue choice alone, before the meeting even got started, Putin was sending a message. Germany and Russia have a special relationship. There's a special partnership here. But what makes this meeting even more interesting is a report from the EU Observer this week. And this is based on what they say that a Ukrainian government source told them. And they said that during this meeting, basically, Angela Merkel did a deal with Putin, that Vladimir Putin would use his influence with the Taliban to stop the to try and get the Taliban to stop refugees coming to Europe. And in exchange, Germany would back down and make some concessions to Russia over Crimea. And now that is just one source. I think the EU Observer is a credible source, and I don't think they would have published it unless they had some confidence, or unless the person talking to them was reasonably credible. But the circumstantial evidence, I think, especially around this meeting, is very compelling. The German foreign minister was due, I think it was just a couple of days after that meeting, he was due to attend the Crimea platform. This was a meeting in Ukraine that was designed to show Europe's resolve to back up Ukraine. You know, we've got Ukraine's back. We're standing up for Ukraine against Russia. Russia, don't you dare take more, or keep hold of Crimea, or keep invading Ukraine. After Miss Merkel went to Moscow, the German foreign minister pulled out of that meeting right at the last minute. And instead, Germany sent their energy minister, a much lower ranking minister, and it gave their meeting there much less diplomatic heft. Not only that, but then France and Italy almost immediately followed in Germany's footsteps, downgrading their representatives at this meeting as well. So instead of this being this kind of this big show of support for Ukraine, this whole event fizzled as people of much less interest and importance showed up. And that sent a message too. You know, for all of those European countries canceling their high profile people at this meeting, that sent a message that, well, we haven't got Ukraine's back. The opposite message. So if there was a deal to do with Afghanistan, you can certainly see some evidence of what that individual is saying and potentially being true.
You know, this whole incident with Afghanistan has a lot of European politicians talking about the death of NATO, how important it is that European countries work independently of the United States. This relationship between Germany and Russia is one of particular interest historically and prophetically. We've talked about it quite a lot over the years. You mentioned just how telling it is that Angela Merkel's almost instinctual reaction in a crisis of the type that's happening right now is to turn to Russia. Why is that so concerning specifically?
Yeah, like you said, there's a lot of reasons from history and Bible prophecy. You know, this relationship between Germany and Russia is a very long-standing one, that it's just a fundamental fact to the geography of these two countries. They're two big, powerful countries with very little between them in terms of their borders. So they have a lot of potential to hurt each other. They also have a lot of potential to work together. Russia has vast amounts of natural resources. Germany doesn't have so much, but it often has the expertise that Russia needs to extract those natural resources. So with the kind of the military incentives, the economic incentives, time and again, you have seen Russia and Germany working together. You know, you saw them working to divide up Poland at the end of the 19th century. You know, much better known. 18th century. Much better known, you saw them right before World War II. Hitler and Stalin got together and just divided Eastern Europe between them. And if they do that, you know, Eastern Europe cannot stand against those powers. So there's a lot of important precedent. And this is why throughout a whole lot of the Cold War, a lot of people in America were very nervous about Germany switching sides, because they knew that Germany had that option. That Russia has always been a strong partner for Germany, and so that was a very strong plan B. President Donald Trump, he was very concerned about this potential plan B as well. That's why he talked a lot about this Nord Stream 2 pipeline that they've been building. And so, you know, Germany, up until now, they've been trying to have their cake and eat it. They've been working with Russia. They have built up a partnership with Russia. But then they've not made a clean break from the United States either. They enjoy having Washington pay for Germany's defense. But I think the events of this week could potentially mark an important shift. And maybe the fall of Afghanistan will also be a pivotal moment for German-Russian and German-American relations. And you know, this kind of shift in German relations is absolutely prophesied in the Bible. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has a landmark article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America, and that goes through recent history. It goes through more distant history. He talks about Bible prophecy. Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 13, for example, is one that he zooms in on, and that talks about a seething pot, and the face thereof is towards the north. And he writes in that article, this symbolic language is describing modern Germany. Beneath the surface, that nation is full of simmering dissatisfaction with the current world order. Germans are angry at the United States. And I think that's more true than ever after this week. And they have some real justifications for that after this last week as well. But he talks about how, well, there's also an imperialistic ambition there. And that, well, this seething resentment with the United States is a major part of why they're undermining NATO and going towards Russia. So, you know, that article is a great place to go to understand this relationship and why it is such a critical part of end time Bible prophecy.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break. Coming up, other news happening in the world, including the plight of the Uyghurs in China. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
China has been brutally cracking down on the Uyghur population within its borders, and more evidence emerges all the time that this is actually a genocide. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, a new study published on August 24th provides what I think is the most compelling evidence yet that China is intentionally reducing its population of Uyghur people in a way that meets the criteria to be considered a genocide. So the Uyghurs are a Muslim minority ethnic group that live mainly in the Xinjiang region there in northwest China. And we've spoken on the show many times about the just diabolical concentration camps that the Chinese Communist Party has sent more than a million of these people off to in recent years. China used to deny the existence of those camps, but then it finally did admit that they were in operation, but said that they were just re-education camps. Said all it was doing is trying to educate the Islamic extremism out of these people and just trying to teach them valuable job skills and language skills. So, you know, China claims that this is a wholesome campaign that's going on there. But this new report confirms some of just the most disturbing accusations about what's really happening in Xinjiang and in these camps. And it shows that it's nothing short of genocide that China is authoring. This report is by Adrian Zins. He was behind the bombshell report last year, proving that Chinese authorities are reducing the population of Uyghurs by forcing the women to take drugs and injections, and also forcibly implanting many of them with contraceptive devices, and also forcing others to undergo surgical sterilization. And now his latest findings build on that, and they bring data together to look at what the results, like the big picture results of these policies have been. And it turns out that in 2018, the people in Xinjiang underwent 243 sterilizations per 100,000 people. And just to give some context to that number, the average in the rest of China is 33 sterilizations per 100,000 people. So 243 is dramatically higher than the average. It's 7.4 times higher. And his team found that by 2019, at least 80% of women of childbearing age in southern Xinjiang had either been forcibly implanted with contraceptive devices or surgically sterilized. 80%. So just a stunning figure there. And the 1948 United Nations Genocide Convention has a definition of genocide that includes, quote, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. And then another part of their definition says, inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in part or in whole. And it's easy to see that these forced sterilizations and forced you know, implanting of contraceptive devices. This is all certainly designed to reduce the Uyghur population and thereby destroy part of this ethnic group.
This is explosive information, but there has been a lot of evidence supporting this. This isn't coming out of nowhere. This is very consistent with what we have known about China for quite some time, and just the authoritarian and quite brutal tactics that they're willing to go to. It gives you a very dark peer into kind of the soul of the Chinese leadership, in a way that they would be willing to use these kinds of measures against their own people.
I think that's a great point. Yes, the leadership there is very insecure and view any sort of religion or ideology apart from their communist dogma as a potential threat. So we're seeing Xi Jinping and the whole Communist Party really turn the screws, not just on Muslims. Christians throughout the nation are suffering all kinds of prosecution lately, and I think we should expect all of that to continue. And I think one interesting thing about this report is that it shows just how much the Uyghur population has dropped as a result of China's just sinister campaign there. It turns out that between 2015 and 2018, population growth rates plummeted by 84% in the two largest Uyghur prefectures. Now, population growth is slowing all throughout China, but in Han-majority counties, it declined by only 19%. Mm. So, you know, the Uyghurs are really being exterminated here. And the report shows that if China's genocide of them continues, it'll prevent up to 4.5 million Uyghur births from happening over the next several years. So this is a long-term strategy, but it is profoundly altering the demographics of this region. And if you go by that official definition, it is committing a slow-motion genocide.
It's particularly concerning considering how much power China is amassing. And there are a lot of people who are looking at the direction of events geopolitically in the world, and they're saying, you know, we're looking forward to a Chinese century. They're positioning themselves as kind of the dominant power in the world, or they're certainly aiming for that end. The fact that this is kind of standard practice for them shows the world is entering a darker period for sure.
It definitely is. And that's something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about over the years. In our February 2020 issue, he wrote an article called "The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man." And that article is built around a prophecy in the Bible that says an era called the Times of the Gentiles will begin shortly before the end of this whole age of man trying to rule over himself ends. And in that article, he talks about how American and British leadership, for many years, it was an imperfect but stabilizing force for civilization. Those countries had biblically influenced beliefs in the God-given rights of individuals. They had respect for the rule of law, and they believed in the injustice of the kind of government tyranny that we're seeing there in China. So they did stabilize the world, but that era is now ending. And the times of the Gentiles is beginning. And in this new era, we can expect the rule of law and limitations on government power to just vanish. And Mr. Fleury actually specifically mentions Xinjiang, China in that article. And he says that what's happening there right now is a preview of just how tumultuous those times of the Gentiles will be. But it all shows that the kind of barbarity that's now happening in this, you know, faraway part of China will soon be happening worldwide. So just a very important article there, the climax of man's rule over man.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You can find that in the links to the show notes. The links in the show notes for today's program. Israel's new prime minister is in Washington to visit America's president to talk about the state of the U.S.-Israel relationship and the forces that are working against it. We'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is going to be a very bizarre meeting. It's scheduled to take place about an hour from when we are recording this on Friday. Between Naftali Bennett and Joe Biden, both leaders of which don't really represent their populations that well. Of course, we've talked at length on this program and others about the election steal that has President Biden in office, but also Naftali Bennett is there. And we've written about this, how the fact that he only won about 5% of Israel's vote, and yet because he lied to the population of Israel, he joined the coalition on the left. He's the prime minister. And so you have two leaders are going to sit down and discuss the relationship between Israel and the United States, both of whom don't really represent the major, or the both of whom are figureheads for a larger political movement that's beneath them. And the chief topic of conversation right now is not going to be Afghanistan for them. It's going to be Iran. That's at least what Naftali Bennett hopes to push Mr. Biden on. And this is one of the stories that has been lost, I guess, in the past 3 or 4 weeks. The fact that Iran is now 2 months away from the nuclear weapon. This is what even Israel's defense minister, Benny Gantz, has said as late as this Wednesday. Europe is increasingly worried. We're not going to get into all to the specifications, but over the past 6 months, Iran has been racing towards a nuclear weapon. And the Americans have been trying to get them back on board with the deal that they signed with the Obama administration. But Iran does not want to sign that deal because they determined that it's not even as good as what they can get right now from the Biden administration. And so you've got Naftali Bennett there that represents a government that has sworn that it will not do anything against Iran's nuclear program unless it's in terms of a military strike, unless it's signed off on by the Biden administration. And you have the Biden administration that's busy trying to pull Iran back into a nuclear deal. And their Iran envoy, Robert Malley, said this week that it doesn't look like Iran's going to accept the old deal, which was already horrible. And so the United States is ready to make more painful concessions to Iran so that they potentially won't get a nuclear weapon. Israel's perspective is, while the world watches Afghanistan and what's going on, which is an extreme danger and it does fulfill prophecy, we need to be concerned about Iran's race towards a bomb. And Israel is running out of options. But Israeli citizens don't believe this government will be able to have a military strike on Iran right now because of their cozy relationship with the Biden administration.
A lot of factors at play here, as you said, with these administrations that aren't really representing their people. Just looked at prophetically, Brent, where would you send people to help us to better understand what we can expect from Israel in the time ahead here?
Well, I think we do expect Iran to plow towards a nuclear weapon and the United States to do nothing to stop it. And it's leaving Israel with a very difficult question. And Israel really doesn't really even have the weapons right now to do it. Carolyn Glick said this week, they need to go over there and ask for Moabs. They need to go get the bunker busters. The nuclear program of Iran is under a mountain right now. The only way to get it is through a strike, or else we're going to wake up one day and Iran's going to have a nuclear weapon. And I don't want to distract away from what's going on with Afghanistan, but people need to watch this serious threat. It's more threatening. An Iranian regime with a nuclear weapon threatens the world more than a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan does. And this is happening while the world's attention is on Afghanistan. And perhaps that is part of the play. And we know in terms of biblical prophecy that the Bible says that it's not going to be the Taliban that leads radical Islam to push at a European Union that is going to be this very preliminary strike that leads the world into World War III. It's going to be Iranian-led radical Islam. And so we need to keep our eyes there and watch this. This prophecy is talked about in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. And Mr. Flurry details this prophecy very carefully in his book, The King of the South.
All right. Thank you for that. Brent, we've heard a lot in recent years about the supposed evil of building walls. President Donald Trump was roundly criticized for building a wall on America's southern border, for example. These critics have been silent about the walls going up in Europe. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, it's a story that isn't getting anywhere near the attention that it did when Mr. Trump was building one on the Mexican border. But there's a whole range of countries now in Europe building up their borders. So Lithuania were kind of the first on the act. They are working on building a 3 meter high, 500 kilometer, that would be somewhere around 350 miles along their border with Belarus. Poland announced just this week that they're starting to build a 2.5 meter high border wall. Actually, Hungary was even quicker on the act. They built a wall on their border in Serbia in 2015. Poland is also doubling their number of soldiers that are on the border wall. And then Greece as well. They announced that they completed a 25-mile long border and surveillance system along their border with Turkey. So you're seeing Fortress Europe become a kind of a literal geographic reality as all of these different countries get set up for defense against migrants, get set up for a potential migrant crisis.
It's quite a departure from the rhetoric that we've heard from so many European leaders against walls and against maybe the their reputation for being very open and accepting and so on, a measure of just how much Europe is changing these days.
That's right. You know, we're talking about these key prophecies in the Bible very often on this show, and they do describe a much more militarized and aggressive Europe. I mean, here's one I was just kind of going over this week from the beginning of the book of Joel, where it talks about this European power as being strong, without number, whose teeth are as the teeth of a lion, and he has the cheek teeth of a great lion, you know, this very aggressive and sharp predator. And you look at the image Europe projects, and that's not the image that it projects at the moment. Now, the image that it projects is not the same as the reality. You know, this is also a Europe that will criticize Donald Trump for mistreating migrants while paying somebody who's literally been convicted of war crimes to build a concentration camp to put migrants in. So there is still a lot of hypocrisy there. But, you know, when you see nations putting up razor wire, hundreds of miles of razor wire up across their borders, you're looking at something that's much more like this creature with razor sharp lion teeth that you get described in some of these different biblical passages. So yeah, you're seeing that change in Europe's personality. You saw that change all the way back in 2015, where the migrant crisis kind of forced Europe to become more autocratic. It pushed all of these much more extremist parties into power. And you're seeing them step up and become more militarized in response to these different crises around the world.
Where would you send people to learn more about what we expect prophetically to happen in Europe?
In the March 2016 Trumpet edition, we had a really fascinating article, Germany Migrants and the Big Lie. It was by Mr. McDonald and I. Mr. McDonald wrote most of it. and the point, I mean, this is just a really thought-provoking article where he just kind of went through and showed how the migrant crisis was changing Europe and how you may have even these leaders like German Chancellor Angela Merkel that have kind of very liberal intentions. But the reality is that it is pushing us towards the Europe and it's very quickly becoming the Europe that's described in the Bible. So that's a really interesting place to go to read more about this story.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Richard. The Philippine president made an interesting announcement this week. Some say is positioning him to stay in power long past his term limit, for this will go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Rodrigo Duterte became president of the Philippines back in 2016. That was for a six-year term, which will be ending in June of next year. And the country's constitution says a person is allowed only one presidential term. So it may have looked like this was the end for Duterte, but news this week shows that he may have found kind of a back door into a second presidential term. His daughter, Sara Duterte, will be running for president, and Rodrigo will run as her vice president. So before this, Duterte had been sending some very mixed messages about his plans after 2022. He'd been saying on some occasions that he's anxious to retire, but now it looks like a vice presidential bid on the ticket with a president that he could, you know, given the family dynamic, very likely control. So this calls to mind the castling move that Russian President Vladimir Putin pulled back in 2008 when he was up against constitutional term limits. He stepped into the office of prime minister for a few years, but he carefully selected a president at that time that he knew would submit to him. So Putin really remained the leader of Russia during that time, even though it was not in an official capacity. And it looks like if this situation in the Philippines goes as planned, Duterte may be taking a page out of Putin's playbook there. Back in our January 2018 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet, executive editor Mr. Stephen Fleury wrote an article that calls attention to just this alarming return to strongman rule that's happening in the Philippines and in other nations around the world. In one part of that, he writes, quote, "It's one of the most stunning reversals of history. For nearly two centuries, the dominant geopolitical trend in the world was the spread of democratic, free societies. The British Empire led the way in the 19th century. The United States did it during the 20th century. This century will be totally different. The dominant trend thus far has been the rise of authoritarian strongmen. We are seeing that this experiment with democracy has failed, and we are falling back into a dark age." And then in that same issue of The Trumpet, we devote an article specifically to Rodrigo Duterte, just pointing out that even though many of his policies are admirable, he ignores the law to pursue them. And the article shows that that can be just a very slippery slope and one that can lead into strongman rule. So, you know, it's too soon to say for sure what will happen with the Philippines in 2022, but it could end up being a significant step toward authoritarianism.
All right. Well, we'll link to both of those articles in the show notes, A New Strongman Age and that article about Duterte, the Punisher of the Philippines. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. One final story. Extreme weather in the United States is withering the nation's crops. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, parts of the United States are in their worst drought in 500 years, especially in the western states. But that drought, which is until now, mainly been influencing like rangeland and cattle land in the western states and or fruit plantations on the west coast, is now moving into the Midwest. You've got parts of the North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska. These are all like in America's corn belt or right near it that are experience extreme drought, causing many of the crops to wither. They're saying that the hay in those areas is coming much smaller yields than is normal. The corn, the wheat in those areas is much smaller yields than is normal. I guess just for a way of illustration, they say up there wheat prices are up 12% and corn prices are up 11% just because the supply of those is becoming so low. Well, which is really horrible for America's farmers because this is coming right after the COVID lockdowns. I mean, you had so many like parts of your transportation infrastructure locked down that it was really a bad year for a lot of farmers not being able to get some of their produce to market. And then now coming off that, they're hoping that this was going to be a good year to kind of like recover from that. But then with this huge drought, it's becoming just even worse and worse than that, which does bring to mind many Bible prophecies, like the one in Leviticus 26 about like, if you obey my law, I'll send rain in due season, but if you don't, I won't. And so you're definitely not getting the rain in due season in the western United States. There's probably like an Amos 4 about I'll send rain on one city and not on another. And I do think there is actually some flooding on the eastern United States, but the whole western half of the country is definitely withholding this rain and really leading to a huge agricultural crisis in the country.
Yeah, it's interesting to be in the middle of everything that's going on in Afghanistan, just looking at those chapters of blessings and curses. Leviticus 26, you mentioned, Deuteronomy 28 is another. Where you see the God talking about breaking the pride of America's power, our strength being spent in vain, and prophecies that we associate specifically more with the international crises that are taking place and our foreign policy, right in the middle of all of those are exactly these prophecies of curses reflecting our agricultural state and the way that that'll hit our food production and our crops.
Yeah, that is. I hadn't thought of that before, but if you do go through Leviticus 26 verses 14 through 20, that verse about I will break the pride of your power, and that verse about I'll make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass are like right next to each other. Mm-hmm. And then we've always kind of like that verse about making the heaven as iron and earth as brass has been more like weather catastrophe, is primarily drought. But then you have the pride of your power broken as well. So you have the domestic food production at home and then just the military defeats abroad kind of all together in one package deal.
So where would you send people to learn more about these prophecies? You mentioned Amos 4:7, a really important prophecy. Where can they read more?
Right. Well, I think the two books we can put in here is, first of all, we have our Why Natural Disasters booklet that goes through why natural disasters and all the what the Bible says about when God withholds rain from a society. We also have the Lion Has Roared booklet that goes through Amos, the book of Amos, more specifically. So it won't cover as much about the natural disasters, but it will focus in a little bit more about that, like those verses like rain in one city and not on another.
Thank you for that, Andrew. These are momentous times that we are living through, and these prophecies that we're discussing really do guide our understanding of these events. We really are thankful to have the understanding that comes from that, and it gives perspective that we desperately need during these times. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Zig Ziglar: if you are not willing to learn, no one can help you. If you are determined to learn, no one can stop you. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.